This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Hello, All Souls Trilogy fans. Welcome to episode 16 of the All Souls podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
So, Summer, what are we doing tonight? Obviously, we're continuing our Discovery of Witches read-along, but is there anything to maybe talk about before?
There may have been some announcements earlier this week, and by when I mean this week, I can't tell you when this is going to be posted.
Recently.
In my current week, there was an announcement about perhaps an upcoming book tour.
Yes, that's correct. So today, the day we're recording this, was the day that the World of All Souls book tour, at least the U.S. tour, was announced. And all we know now is that Deb will be there. We're not sure if anybody else will be there. We don't know, but we're very excited. And what we can say now is since, and this is all already out there, the dates, is that Summer and I will actually, alas, be in Scotland. That, to me, is the only alas about being in Scotland.
I mean, we've had this trip planned for a year. She could have planned better.
Summer. It's been planned since technically May of 2017. I mean, okay, that was when it was announced. It's been in the works for over a year and 2 months, a year and over 13 months. But it's been like the actual dates have been pretty much set for probably, I would definitely say early 2017.
I'm just saying.
But yeah, so for a while.
Deb needs to do better next time.
Oh, Summer. Deb, you do you.
It's a little hateful.
You do you, boo.
We're only out of the country 2 weeks next year.
This year?
Yes. 2 weeks this year.
Summer's having a hard time with the fact that it's already 2018. Oh, so am I. With the fact that it's 2018.
It's not. Take it back. Anyway, my point still stands. We are only out of the country 2 weeks this year, and she planned her book tour during those 2 weeks. That's all I'm saying.
And it literally almost coincides exactly with those 2 weeks.
Wait, what if it's completely intentional? What if she's super tired of seeing your face? Your face, not mine, yours.
My face is never anywhere. Uh-huh. I've seen her three times in the last 2.5 years.
It's a lot, Ginger. I've seen you at least that much in the last...
No, don't tell everybody why we record separately now. Because your face. Oh, no, wait.
Your kiss is on my list.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, definitely not your kiss because that would
because
be incestual.
Because your face, it's out of place.
Oh, Lord.
Something like that.
Because your face.
Oh, wow. Okay, calm down. That was too high. Did you see what I posted on Facebook for you? You're the only one who hasn't commented on it.
There's a reason for that.
So you did see it.
You want to know what I saw tonight? I don't know. And I'm surprised, unless it's like really, sometimes you'll see a post that comes up in your feed and it's like a week late or something. It depends on, it's all about, of course, engagement and whatever. You could be following, because the whole time, the whole algorithm, I'm sorry, it's screwed up. Facebook, it's screwy. Anyway, I saw one of my favorite musical pages. As a music major, I'm of course really geeky about a lot of musical things. That's why I can't wait. I mean, we know about the composer now, but I cannot wait to to get my metaphorical hands on that composer as far as like chatting with him. I cannot wait. So, I mean, but I mean some kind of preposition or whatever word that is. It's not a preposition. Conjunction. So one of my favorite pages is called The Diction Police, and it's actually a page for music lovers, musicians, predominantly singers, but they have a lot of different, you know, a lot of different types of posts. But most specifically, the person or people behind this site, behind this page, they do offer a service, is they help with basically vocal coaching. I don't know what their nationality is. I believe they are native English speakers, but they live and work in Germany, which of course has a huge and flourishing opera community. That I mean, you could say community, industry, I guess. Anyway, and so they shared the same thing. And they were wondering, like, huh, I wonder if this means like you can practice in your apartment and no one would know. So whereas Summer was trying to say, look, we can get ginger, we can muffle ginger. They were saying, huh, I wonder if this actually has an application that's good for singers. I thought that was funny. I'm like, I've seen it. I just don't advertise it. So.
Mm-hmm. What cities is she going to?
Oh, my goodness. Let's talk about that. Deborah is going to Seattle, Houston, Los Angeles, Raleigh, North Carolina. I mean, I think you guys probably knew that. Asheville, North Carolina. Hot diggity dang. Two, and California gets one. I'm not throwing shade, y'all. But North Carolina gets two. Hot diggity. Congrats, you guys. That's awesome. New York isn't even on this list. Cincinnati, Ohio, and Philadelphia, PA. That's pretty awesome.
I'm not going to lie. If I had a choice, I would go to Asheville, North Carolina.
I know you would. If I had a choice, well, okay. All things being equal, I still would probably go. I would have to fly. I probably would go to Seattle because, okay, it's West Coast, obviously. I have nothing against LA. Whichever you do is going to be like busy, but I think LA is definitely busier than Seattle. But yeah, I mean, we have friends in areas of both places, so not a big deal. But yeah, so there's plenty. I mean, not like gobs, but a decent. She's doing pretty well, you know, covering a decent amount of cities. And we hope you guys are as excited as we are. And by the time this comes out, this will be old news, but we got to do it as it's fresh and exciting. So, Sam, what is – I already gave this away, but what are we going to talk about tonight?
Tonight we are going to be discussing chapter 15.
That is correct. So what I didn't write down was
– I was trying to think of a
– Of a segue?
No, not a segue, of an alternate title for chapter 15. Oh,
well, okay. That's cool. So if you could come up with it beforehand, that's awesome. But a lot of times they kind of come with the chat.
Let's see. Chapter 15, wherein Ashmole 782 gets lost.
I mean, for like the 703rd time.
And then, you know, crime scene photos are revealed.
Oh, yeah. There's some pretty not so fun stuff in this chapter. Okay, so it's a Monday morning at dawn, and Diana is keen to go rowing. She's one of the first ones on the river, and she gets a great workout in. And as she finishes, Matthew, of course, is waiting for her at the boathouse. She's aghast. Now, it's not that she's not – we don't know. Deborah does not tell us that she's surprised or not surprised, probably not, to see him there. What she does express surprise at is his scarf. Deborah describes it as, quote, an ancient brown and bone striped new college scarf, unquote. And she's like, where did you get that? He's like, oh, I think from like around 1920 or something. He's not, I mean, he dresses well, don't get me wrong, but he's not, I guess, he's not concerned. He's like.
Well, I think that if Diana is surprised to see him there, she's legitimately the only one.
Oh, gosh. I know. The readers are like, yeah. So Matthew offers to help her with the boat as she gets out of the water. And she's like, no. And she's like, I got it. He talks her into breakfast. And she's like, probably not a bad idea because it's going to be a long day. So they go to a place called Mary and Dan's Cafe. Now, had they been there before in the book or no?
Is it the place that she goes all the time because she always orders the same thing?
She has a usual. But maybe there's a scene that takes place later in the book. But something goes down, not like violent or anything, but something goes down in the cafe at some point, or in some cafe, and I don't mean the one across from you know, that she goes, like, not Blackwell's
with Miriam, the one she played into with Miriam.
Yeah, not that one. Yeah, so I don't know, so we'll see. But this trip anyway is quite, I mean, quick. I mean, she eats and then they go. And he steers her with his hand on her elbow. And Diana notes, quote, his hand firmer on my back than before, unquote. So over the chapters, at least since they've met, as their exposure to one another grows or continues, and their attraction, obviously all of that, the pull toward each other, Deb gives us little things like this, little descriptions like this, that are textual evidence for their growing closeness. As a matter of fact, this I cry whenever I read it. Okay, the first time I read it, I probably didn't cry because I didn't know. I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. That's beautifully written. But I never cried because it was not meaningless, but not as meaningful as it would become by the end of the book, let alone the end of the trilogy. And we'll get to that at the very end. But it is one of my favorite parts, that themes that continues throughout the entire trilogy. So we get a description of how he's, you know, even more protective of her, even more into her. And
see, now you say that he leads her by the elbow, which is probably the appropriate way to lead someone who is, you know, comparably sized to you. But I know as a mother, the easiest way to guide a smaller person than you is by the head. I used to take my daughter's head and turn it. And turn it the direction I wanted her to walk. And she would go. But she never,
like a I'm horse, sure that, you turn exactly. her head and she goes.
And I would just put the top, my hand on the top of her head, and I would just like turn it the way I wanted her to go, and she'd go. She doesn't like it now. And I'm sure that an adult wouldn't care for it if you tried it on them. No. However, small children works really well.
So as Summer said, she noted that Diana is known in this cafe. At least Mary knows her. And she says the usual, and Mary brings it, and it is eggs, bacon, mushrooms, and tomatoes. And I wrote, oh, yum, except
she
the
brings
bacon.
It.
But even the bacon.
She brings it.
Oh, no, but even the bacon sounds yum. I don't – I'm vegetarian. Summer is very happily not. But I would eat – Summer, you would eat all that but the tomatoes, right?
I wouldn't – I don't wouldn't want the mushrooms.
Oh, you wouldn't – you're like, save the veg. I'll take the eggs and bacon.
Right. See, we could totally split a British – A full English breakfast between the two of us, and both be satisfied.
No, we could no, because I'd want the eggs, because that's all the protein I get. You could have all the black pudding, the bacon, the sausage.
Come on, there's beans. You could have beans.
Yeah, but those are carby.
I know. I'm such ruining everything. I was coming up with a great way for us to save money,
but
and you
I
just
do like. Actually, that's not a bad idea. If we go to Scotland,
that's what I'm saying. I am smart and frugal.
Yes, you are. That's not a bad idea. If we can cut it, we'll see. I think it's a good idea. So after breakfast, she's like, in and out. After breakfast, she showers and changes, and the porters betting on their relationship, like how, or at least Deb uses the words like the porters are betting, like, you know, how, what would their relationship be? Because it's like, it's so formal, like, you know, they're together, but they like don't spend the night. And you know what I mean? It's like, and they're older. They're not like, you know, 18 year olds. Well, even 18 year olds will spend the night, but you know what I mean? Very old fashioned, kind of. But she'd finally convinced Matthew to just drop her off. So that morning, I got the sense, because Deb kind of said it, but didn't come out straight out and say it, that because of her anxiety and the stress of the day that she's pretty sure she knows is going to come, she deliberately is taking her time. There's no rush. She wants to be calm as possible, not only during the day, but in her prep for the day, like trying to set a mood, trying to set a physical mood for her body and a physical feeling.
Why should she rush? If she's the only one that can call the manuscript up, not going anywhere.
Fair enough. Fair enough. She puts on black trousers, a turtleneck, a midnight blue cardigan, and her hair is caught up in a low ponytail. I gotta tell you, there are so many differences, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time in this, but whereas I still to this day do not see Katrina Balfe as Claire in Outlander, I'm already starting to see Teresa Palmer as
You know,
Diana.
I don't even know why she bothered to say what she was putting on in the first half of this book, because they're all the same. It's I put on a cardigan and a turtleneck and some khakis.
True.
I mean, until we move forward – in this story, and honestly, probably not even this book, until book two, I don't think there's anything interesting in her clothing that's
hello.
Worth noting. So, I mean, it's just like, I bet she just had a glass jar with a bunch of pieces of paper in it, one with like colors and a jar with colors, a jar with the word cardigan, and a jar with the word khakis. And she just was like, blue turtleneck, cardigan, black khakis.
So do you didn't – well, okay, I didn't answer – I did not ask you a direct question. Do you see Teresa Palmer in your head as you're listening or reading?
No, not yet. No, and until I see the show. Once I see the show, it changes everything, you know what I mean? Because then you're immersed in everything that it is. It's, you know, it's just – there are certain characters who have already meshed for me, book versus – TV show, that I'm like, okay, I get it. I can totally be on board with that one. And I think I said this the last time, or that I'm like, I feel like I'm trying to shove them into their parts against their will and against my will. But, you know, I'm excited. I think that I sound like I'm down on it, but I'm really not. I think that, I don't know. It just sounds like I'm being kind of down on it, and I'm not.
We do have to get back to the chapter, but I can add a little bit of naughty to this. And that is, I'm little by little watching season two. I mean, I started watching season two of The Crown, like maybe a month ago, whatever it came out, like a week after it came out, I started watching it. And I watched like the first episode, and it's not boring at all. But I choose to watch things when I get home from work or at night as I'm just kind of reclining. And that's not necessarily the best time, because then you wake up and it's like episode 8 and you're like, oh, I missed like 7 episodes. So I've like technically gone through it probably 3 times, but I've only watched a few episodes fully awake. So I'm very slowly watching it, basically, is what I mean. And I knew Matthew Good was in it. I had seen him. I had even like woken up and there was an episode he was in. I was like, oh, there he is. But I never like followed the actual storyline with him until I went through and watched one by one, or was able to watch one by one. And his character is a little bit naughty, but not judging. I'm not judging naughty. I mean, I'm being naughty like in a very prim sort of way, but or prudish prim, but holy smokies. Okay, I never had anything against Matthew Good. I don't know him from Tom, Dick, or Harry. However, I mean, I liked him. I think he's attractive, and I think he's an excellent actor. But I didn't know enough of his stuff. Can I tell you? Did you watch The Crown season 2?
I did.
Oh, girl. Okay, I haven't finished it, so don't go there. But I'm on like episode 9, so I'm almost done. Can we talk about, just for a hot second, without giving any storyline away, the Smexy time scene with his ridiculously gorgeous Asian photograph subject? What?
Yeah.
He had nookie and a half!
I was very distracted by his blonde hair and incredibly skinny body.
Okay, he's not...
I think he's filled out a lot since he filmed The Crown. And I
probably so. I'm not even talking about that, but girl, he is Smexy!
Okay.
Is that a no? You don't agree with me?
I wasn't feeling Matthew Good in The Crown.
Oh, I was feeling Matthew Good. I was feeling quite Matthew Good in The Crown.
And that's fine. I'm just saying, I enjoy The Crown, and I enjoyed the season of The Crown. I'm looking forward to finding him attractive again.
Okay, I've never not found him attractive, but I get what you mean. He's portrayed or...
It was not my favorite version of Matthew Good. That's it. And that's okay.
Yeah, that's fair. Oh, that's totally fair. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, even if it wasn't your favorite version of him, I totally get it. I find him an attractive man.
I thought you said I find him unattractive.
Summer.
I was like, what?
No, I find him to be an attractive man. Okay, yes, he's attractive. And he's tall. And he's lithe. Whatever. He's a wonderful actor. All of that. I'm not saying any of that is not true. But I've never seen him as like, or considered him. While I consider him good looking, I never considered him like a sex symbol type of thing. Like, I just don't. Not like, you know, back in the 90s when I thought Brad Pitt was like maybe a sex symbol, or I don't know, whoever, a lot of dudes. But and he's not maybe the classic sex symbol, if you will, but holy Kismo, I've never not liked him since I've known of him, but especially since his casting, of course, since his casting as Matthew de Clermont, I've been more aware of him, and of thus have been looking out. I don't go searching for him, but when I see him, he definitely gets my attention and everything I see him in now. And I'm thinking, oh, that's Matthew. And obviously he was he was a photographer in The Crown. He was not Matthew in The Crown. But I see, like, I see little glimpses of him as he's acting in different scenes. And I'm, and I see something that might be part of Matthew. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, Matthew has this, I could, of course, we haven't seen anything yet. We have no idea how he plays Matthew, but the brooding kind of thing, you know, I just, I see what I think might be glimpses of what we might get as Matthew. And it's just, it even makes him even more attractive. So, okay, I'll stop there because we need to get on. They haven't even gone to the library yet.
She's barely got her khakis on.
Oh, Lord. So they, okay, as I said, they weren't there, but now they're there. So at the library, she gets past the guard. And apparently the guard was like, I don't know what was up. Was like, did she have some kind of, not a glamour, but the guard was like, giving her, not giving her verbal guff, but like looking really hard at her ID. Like, is she really, you know what I mean? I'm like, that's kind of wackadoodle because she's been there like every day for how many weeks now? And she goes up to Duke Humphreys and she's so happy to see him. But, and by him, of course, I mean Matthew. But she finds out that Peter Knox is indeed there. He is in the Selden End. And she goes and requests her manuscripts from Sean and writes a slip to recall Ashmole 782. Sean at the collection desk asks to speak with her. He wants to know, because Matthew's there at the table, he wants to know if Matthew is bothering her. He, a human, has noticed that things are kind of funky down too. Quote, I don't like him. The whole place has been full of strange ducks over the last week or so, unquote. So that's a human saying that she's be wiggy wiggy whack.
Well, that's the whole reason that they don't intermingle. It draws exactly. too much attention.
So she promises Sean, I will let you know if something is wrong or goes wrong. And then she tells Matthew that Sean, even Sean knows something is up. Sitting there trying to concentrate, they're just trying to pass the time, or at least she is, until Ashmole comes out, because that's what the whole crowd is there to see happen as more and more people collect. So she's trying to concentrate and it's just not working. Quote, caught between a vampire and the call desk. I loved it. It was like, that, to me, that's a perfect title. I mean, that's, it's not episode title, not a chapter title. Not that you can't come up with an episode title. That is up for grabs. It's just whatever sounds best. Okay. And then came Peter Knox. Matthew warns him about getting closer to Diana. She feels a pressure in her head and a voice in her skull. So she knows, obviously, we all know that Knox is working on her again. Matthew again defends her. And she says, quote, Mr. Knox was just leaving, unquote. And he supposedly turns to leave, but he says, quote, I hope you understand what you're doing, unquote. So here's another threat, as in, you have chosen your side. Remember that. When Matthew reacts to this with a growl and Diana placed her hand on his arm, Knox immediately notices a witch and a vampire are touching. Until that moment, Knox had only suspected that Matthew and Diana were... Oh, sorry. Hold on. Quote, until that moment, Knox had only suspected that Matthew and I were too close for the comfort of witches. Now he was sure, unquote. Diana tries to push against his voice in her head, Knox's voice, and she can't. Knox is much stronger than her. There's no way. She's no match for him at all. Knox knows she's told Matthew about the book. And now it's Knox who is attracting the attention of the humans. He says, quote, you've caught the attention of more than humans this morning, Dr. Bishop. Before nightfall, every witch in Oxford will know you're a traitor, unquote. Matthew is tight. His muscles are tight and he is ready to spring.
They're tight.
He touches that small...
Matthew is so tight right now.
Summer. They are tight. He touches I believe it's the ampulla of Bethany, his little thing he has on a cord around his neck under his sweater, under his shirt. And Diana puts herself between them and gets Knox to leave. Diana wants to stay and get the manuscript. She's like, we have waited. We have gone through too much and waited too long to not get it. And Matthew wants to go now. She takes some of the blame for Knox's reaction. Quote, it's my fault. I shouldn't have touched you while he was standing there. And Matthew asks her, do you regret the touch or the fact that the witch saw you? Unquote. When she responds, neither, we get a feel for Matthew's demeanor. Quote, his eyes went from sad to surprised in an instant. Unquote. Knox brings his things to their area, a few desks away, though. Matthew says one more word to her, and they'll leave. After this, Diana can't concentrate at all. She didn't want to stop for lunch. She's like, we can't take a chance that the manuscript is called up and we're gone and Knox is here. And then a demon passes by and asks, can I check my email here? But down away in the area, but away from them, since Knox is there as well. And the demon is named Timothy. And they say, Diana says, okay, go ahead. And as he walks away, he says to Diana, you're the one. I thought that was a little bit funky town. I mean, I know he's a demon, so he's like brilliant and dreamy and not twisted, but potentially tormented, right? And I mean, gracious, how freaky would that be if someone walked by and said, oh, you're the one. I just get this, like, what are those animals from that are freaky from The Dark Crystal?
Yexies.
Yes, I get this. You're the one. That's what I get in my head.
Well, fortunately for me and anyone who was not you, apparently, who listened to the audiobook, Jennifer Ikeda had him say it more like, you're the one, like, thanks, you're the best. Thanks. So it was like a double meaning. So it could have been just like a colloquialism that also like had double meanings.
You mean like, you're the one, dun, 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 dun,
nope.
You're
the nope. one. Nope, nope, that wasn't even necessary. No, it's just like, like when you're saying, hey, thanks. That's how it came up when she read it. Like, you're the one, thanks. Not, you're the one, or I'm a creepy Skeksis, you're the one. No, that's not how she didn't read it like that. So that's not how I interpreted that. But I like the double meaning of the way that Jennifer Ikeda interpreted it.
So when the manuscript didn't appear an hour later, Diana goes to check on it. And she's told it's missing. Not only like gone now, but it's been missing since 1859, even though she'd seen it a few weeks before. And they say, yeah, that's not possible. Matthew says they're leaving now. All of the other creatures there were focused intently on them. He says, do not talk or think about the book as we make our way out. And Deborah writes, quote, I obediently started reciting English monarchs in my head, beginning with William the Conqueror, unquote. Because I have never had to do anything like that as I leave a library, and witches and demons are like watching me. I haven't done that, thank goodness. But I have, in order to, well, for me, it's usually not to not think about something. It's usually to keep something in my head. So if I'm trying to remember a number or trying to remember something, I will like chant it, hopefully out loud, at least loud enough for me to hear it. But if not, then, you know, definitely in my head, like quietly, like, don't talk to me, I gotta do this kind of thing. And what do you know, as they leave, the other creatures are leaving too. She has failed to recall the manuscript. That means everyone, not just them, will have to regroup. Matthew tells Sean they're done for the day. We'll be like, we're going now. We're done.
And it's not just that she wasn't able to recall the book, but it's that everybody knows. Like, they were all there for it. You're like, that's embarrassing.
Well, so it's bad because they don't get it, right? Because they want to see it again and actually do more work on it. That's like the most important thing. But it's also bad because she failed. Or it failed, whatever. But others see her and she feels it herself, right? She fails with an audience. So not only do they don't get the out, do they not get the outcome and information they hoped they would able to get, she has to fail in front of an audience, and that's rough. And the audience is only going to grow. As he said, everyone will know by that night.
Well, and it was every group was represented.
Yeah.
They're all going to go back to their collective groups and not only regroup, but tell the tale far and wide of the witch who couldn't recall the manuscript. As they leave the library,
they're out near the courtyard and they see Nox. Nox is convinced Diana is a weak witch. And well, let's be honest, at this moment, she is.
Let's be even more honest than that. That's the thing for her to be.
Well, and she hasn't had any training, so she doesn't know what else to be. Right? I mean, I think she knows she could try more, but she on purpose, as you said, on purpose tries to batten down the hatches, you know, at any time or at all the time. And then things like the whole blue sparky flamey things happen like later in this chapter. And that happens because
the safest thing for her to be is non-threatening. Because if she shows herself to be a strong witch, they will be threatened by it and will be like, oh, well, let's see if I can take her on, right? But she either has to be so powerful that they are threatened by that and don't want a chance messing with her, or she has to be so weak that she's not worth it.
And not a threat. Exactly.
Exactly.
So he thinks it's a fluke that she called it up at all. And it's a good thing that she didn't get it a second time, because it can't fall into the hands of, quote, animals like him. And he follows up with, quote, witches and vampires don't mix, unquote. So this is where, although it's been hinted at, Matthew has talked about a little bit of it in the chapter, especially in his lab, we're talking about genetics and everything and DNA. This, dear listener, is the biggest overarching theme of the entire trilogy. The similarities of humankind, are much greater than its differences. And those who hold the opposite viewpoint, at least in the novels, are of the old order. We will see this theme as the basis for conflict of even our most beloved characters. And we will love them through it, because they're not all of our beloved characters are necessarily as progressive as others, right? But do you remember this this theme coming? Well, we know the theme runs through all the books. It's overarching theme. Like Deborah has said that in book one, it's a mother theme. In book two, it's a father theme. And then in book three, it's maybe a children theme or family kind of thing. She mentioned that in our interview back a few years ago, if I'm not mistaken. And even though each book definitely has like its own more intimate theme, it's more detailed theme for based on things that are happening inside that book, specific events or the storylines. Would you agree, Summer, that this whole thing, the whole story about forget Matthew and Diana, the whole story about the three creatures and how they are not allowed to mix and how they keep each other keep separate on purpose to help keep everyone safe because it's out of fear. And that, at least early days, and ends up, you know, hundreds or thousands of years later, ends up that, you know, I don't know if you'd use the word racism, but definitely creaturism. You know, you acknowledge that they exist, but you do not hang out with those. You, God forbid, you like, no, you don't date a witch. You know what I mean? So it's those lines that I just read are so, you could literally replace those lines with, you don't date a person of that race. You don't hang out with people. You don't hang out with people from that country.
It's West Side Story. it's the Jets and the Sharks. Was it Sharks and Jets? Is that right? Okay. It's been a while. It's any musical where there's two or more groups of people that are not allowed to intermingle for whatever the reason.
And it doesn't have to, it can be skin color, it can be nationality, it can be religion. Oh my goodness. Yes, really, duh. We still have religious infighting or X, whatever. Religion is still a huge, it can bring many people together, but it also divides a lot. divides many people, as well as class. Or if we Americans are offended by that word, then economic status. Is that better? So different. There are so many things that you can use in place of the term of the reason of skin color or the reason of religion. You know, there's so many things you can put in there, and that is something that so many readers love about Deb's trilogy, is that the theme of the books. Yes, we love the characters, we love the description of history, we love reading about the I almost gave a not really a spoiler, but you know, talked about book two. We love what they do. We love the magic. I and so many people love the science. Of course, we love all of this. But Deb's story, if you step back, her trilogy is trying to say we are all worthy. Everyone is worthy, regardless of all of those descriptors we just gave. And that's the overarching one. And you look at creatures, but then you get into like Diana and you get into Matthew and you get into, that overarching one is then seen inside each character. So yeah, we could go on forever about that, but it's so fascinating. So fascinating. What a gift we have in these books. Okay, that's it. Matthew's fate is sealed. Spending time with, I said it. Okay, I'll read it and see how it goes. Spending time with it may have strengthened his bond to Diana, but the threats to her by Knox trigger his protection mechanisms like nothing else. And there is no one else he'd protect like this, like a mate or child. But Knox cannot let this go. He won't leave her alone. Quote, "She belongs to us, not you. So does the manuscript," unquote. They finally leave and they're walking by Radcliffe Camera, and he walks her to his rooms and deposits her on his couch, and he goes to get her a glass of water. Matthew is PO'd that he didn't follow his instincts as soon as she saw Ashmole 782. And Diana is upset and probably a little bit mortified, embarrassed as well, that she couldn't recall it. Matthew tells her that she'll be staying in Woodstock for a few days and to make sure that she's away from Knox. And she thinks that she's out of the woods now that she's not able to get the manuscript. Another sign that Matthew is agitated, his, quote, "normally impeccable appearance was suffering," unquote. So Matthew probably has like some stray hairs, or like his tie is loose, or maybe he's like, you know, got lint on him, or got like part of his shirt's on, who knows? But he's not 100% like perfection at this moment. Both Knox and Matthew are convinced the manuscript hides things that some creatures wouldn't want others to know, etc. Diana's not so sure. Now, they have a strong discussion about the origins and purpose of the manuscript. Was it purely allegorical, or was it an alchemical story of creation, or was it more? Diana doesn't like that both Matthew and Knox, at the heart of things, even though they're completely on separate sides, they both want to keep information in the manuscript from getting to others. Diana starts to pack up her things. She's had it. She's like, I'm not going to sit here and talk to you about this. She starts to pack up and she's losing control. She's angry. Quote, "my hands itched," unquote. And quote, "my fingers were brilliant blue and shooting out little arcs of fire that sputtered at the edges like the sparklers on his birthday cakes," unquote.
Is that her code name for his butt?
Oh, summer.
His birthday cakes.
Oh, Lord. And quote, "I ran for the kitchen, trailing sparks," unquote. I think that's my favorite. Matthew, having smelled what was coming out of her fingers, says, "don't put them underwater," and that they smelled electrical. And he says, "obviously you're angry." And she says, quote, "I don't do angry," unquote. It's the best lie ever, Diana. And he's all, "yes, you do." Here she is, like everything else, right? Like trying to batten down the hatches, yes, for her safety, but also just in denial. She's in denial a little bit. She's not in denial. She's a witch. She knows she's a witch, but she's in, she
She's not in denial of her powers or of herself, but she denies herself. You know the difference? That, you know, she'll never say she's not a witch. That's denying herself. But sorry, that's being in denial or lying. But she does deny herself of the advantage, potential advantage of her powers. Not a huge thing right now because she's not that well trained. And that's for her on purpose, at least at this moment. She is trying yet again to ignore things, to push things down, to not confront what's going on. And that is how all of the stuff, when she tries to ignore it and tries to push things down, she gets blue electrical sparks coming out of her fingers.
I was going to say, she needs to come up with some new tactics because these clearly are no longer working for her. And maybe they never were.
So they have a bit of a spat here. His hand grabs her and turns her around. He says, quote, "I warned you. Friendships with vampires are complicated. I couldn't let you go now, even if I wanted to," unquote. And she learned why one shouldn't turn their back on a vampire if you're arguing. He pulls her back against his chest, his muscles taut. He says that they will discuss this and that she's not going to run away from this or from him. She tells him to let her go and he flat out says, nope. And the more she struggled, the tighter his arms got. It's kind of like a reflex. Does that remind you of anything?
Rape?
No.
No?
I mean, I'm not saying that's not possible. I'm saying that's not what I was expecting. No, vampires are predators.
I know, but he's being a little rapey right now. No means no, dude.
Okay, well, I don't disagree. But as a predator, and I don't mean like a predatory human male. I mean a predator in Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. If you have a...
Do they even do that anymore? Mutual. No. Does Mutual of Omaha even exist anymore?
I have no clue. So... the first thing that comes to my mind is a python, but I don't think that's a good example. But basically an animal that grabs its prey, and the more the prey struggles, the harder and tighter the predator either squeezes or bites down.
Like a snake?
Yeah, that's what I mean, a python. That's why I said maybe a python. But it's a reflex for him. He right here, for Matthew, this is a cool head, right? He has... he's got himself under control, but he's still a predator. And that's why he gets the more she struggled, the tighter his arms get. She's no match for him physically. And they both know this. She says, "Let me go and then we'll talk." And he's like, "Nope, I want answers. I want answers." Question number one, how often do your fingers get blue? And she says, "A few times when I was a kid and then the previous week." Now this whole time, he's speaking to her and his breath tickles the back of her neck. And just as a predator will hold on to its prey, the more it struggles, the tighter it holds. He is also mesmerizing her. Quote, "resting his cheek against the side of my head, it was comforting if I overlooked the fact that he was holding me against my wishes," unquote. Or as a summer would say, "it was really strong and manly if I overlooked the fact that he was being rapey."
Super rapey.
So Miriam, she describes the incident that had happened the week before. Miriam had made her upset, accusing her of playing damsel in distress. Matthew finds this interesting that she's had the reaction twice within a week. And that's why he asked her about it. So if she hadn't had it at all since she was a child and then suddenly she has it twice in a week, he's thinking, I've been acting differently. You've been acting differently, whether it's because of something between us or a change in circumstances in your life that are bringing your power up, bringing things up. This is interesting. The timeliness is interesting. Now he asks her why he wouldn't be interested in anything in the manuscript. Now this she's embarrassed to talk about because she had had that conversation with Sarah and M. And since he's got a hold of her and he won't let go of her unless she tells the truth because he knows when she's lying. She says that Sarah and M said that the only reason he's spending time with her was because of the manuscript and that he would have no interest in her personally. Now here is when he gets smexy. He says, quote, "but that's not true, is it?" he said, running his lips and cheek against my hair. and her blood sings in response. Connection. And he laughs at this. Quote, I didn't think you believed it, he said. I just wanted to be sure. Unquote. He puts his foot down. You will be staying in Woodstock. Upside, you can have all the yoga you want.
I so thought you were saying yogurt. And it's is that a thing? I mean, I like yogurt now. Don't judge. Unlimited yogurt was never a selling point on anything.
He warns her, though, that the conversation about the blue fingers and the manuscript, they are not over. As Matthew takes her to her rooms, she goes to pack. On the way, she collects her mail. Bills and a large brown envelope. No stamp, though. Inside, which means, it didn't come through the normal post. It likely came from intercampus mail. Inside the large envelope was a piece of paper with the word remember typed onto it. And this piece of paper was attached to a shiny photograph. It was a color version of the black and white shot she'd seen before. It was the photograph of her parents' bodies slaughtered in 1983 in Africa.
Right. Now, here's my question. The graphic detail that Diana describes as
being... That who describes?
Diana. The character, Diana, describes
okay. I was like,
it's as been... being okay. in the picture.
Yes.
And saying that she's only seen this picture once before, and or she's seen it before when it was in black and white and they ran it in a newspaper. They ran a picture in the newspaper of this dude with his entrails out? That seems awfully graphic for a newspaper.
That's a little hard. That's a little hard to believe. I agree.
Like, that seems a little graphic for a newspaper. I mean, I feel like I'd have to go super dark web to find pictures like that on the internet.
Oh, gosh. Let's not talk about that. So she, of course, is shocked and terrified and disgusted and just mostly shocked. And she collapses. Matthew, he's like downstairs somewhere, he can tell that something is going on. He gets up to her as fast as he can, accompanied by Fred the porter. Matthew has Fred move his car, and he goes in and he sees that Diana's ill. She like full on vomits in the toilet. Thankfully, she makes it to the toilet. But Matthew is caring for her. She tells him what was in the picture and that Jillian had told her that witches killed her parents. And Matthew was like, goes into like shock, but not rescue, but like male mode, right? Or a typical male or typical anyone who's trying to help, like, let's fix this. What can I do? Let's go here. I'm going to get a plane. We're going to pack. We're going to go straight to Africa. And
didn't you find that convenient as well?
For him?
And here's why. And convenience probably not the right word. But I found it strange that for someone who knows as much as he knows about everything, that he didn't know that her parents were already dead.
Yeah. Probably. Okay. I can see that. Absolutely. But I think the part that the two reasons it doesn't surprise me is, number one, obviously she doesn't go around telling people that. So he wouldn't have heard from her. But number two.
He wouldn't have. But he knew all about her when he met her.
But number two, about her professionally. He didn't know about necessarily her upbringing.
Oh, I bet he knows.
Well, obviously he didn't know. He didn't know her parents were dead.
I'm just saying, I feel like he should have known.
I don't disagree, but I think the two reasons that it doesn't surprise me is that where would he find it out? He wouldn't hear from her, obviously.
He doesn't have to hear from her. If he did an internet search where he did a background check with a whatever, you would see parents and all of those things, and you'd be able to see, he would know all about her. If he knew where she went to college, where she came from.
Okay, well, let me say my second point, and then I'll go back to you, because I think that's a good point. So my first point is that he wouldn't hear from her. The second thing is that he doesn't hang out with witches, right? That's taboo, except for her, which he's not asking her, and so he wouldn't hear it from other witches. However, I agree with you. If he looked up, because he already had all this DNA stuff about the bishops, right? Or at least one of the bishops, right?
Yeah.
He knows her last name is Bishop. He knows at least a little bit about her lineage. I agree. He didn't have her DNA until she came. But yeah, that's just, that's hard to believe. Not that he would not know before she got there, because he had no reason to be interested in her until Ashmole was called, right? Mm-hmm. Once Ashimel was called, then he's like, who the heck is that witch? Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. That's a little odd because all you have to do is type in her name. Now, he'd probably like Google the heck out of her and her history. I don't necessarily think because you see someone you're interested in, whether it's romantically or professionally, I don't go Google people's parents.
You wouldn't have to.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. If your parents are so brutally murdered and it's an international affair.
Yeah. There's an obituary. There's an obituary that will mention,
yeah,
you know, they are survived by their only daughter, Diana Bishop. Like her name would have been mentioned in any obituary that was posted about it.
So he is thinking, oh, let me do this and this and this, and we will go there. I'm so sorry. Let's go. This is awful. How can I help? Let's do this. Let's go to Africa right now. He's shocked to learn that they were killed when she was 7. He tells her, quote, I will not let Nox or any other witch harm you. I've got you now, unquote. And then, quote, oh, Diana, why didn't you tell me this? Unquote. So obviously,
right.
He didn't know. But yeah, it's a little bit odd. I'm not saying it's like, I don't think it's shady. I just think it's surprising. And this, okay, whew, this is my favorite part.
Any drugs are? No?
No, Summer.
Okay.
No. We're not there. No. That's at the very end. Okay, this is before that. Wait up, you druggie. And this is the first time we read or listen to about this beautiful metaphoric linking of these two. Quote, somewhere in the center of my soul, a rusty chain began to unwind. It freed itself link by link from where it had rested unobserved, waiting for him. My hands, which had been balled up and pressed against his chest, unfurled with it. The chain continued to drop to an unfathomable depth where there was nothing but darkness and Matthew. And at last it snapped to its full length, anchoring me to a vampire. Despite the manuscript, despite the fact that my hands contained enough voltage to run a microwave, and despite the photograph, as long as I was connected to him, I was safe. Unquote. This is something, this chain that links them, or this link between them. First of all, the fact that it's now entered into the story is the metaphor. Although we've gotten the hints, we've gotten the physical side of Diana and the physical side of Matthew. This is how Diana feels it. We don't get this description ever from Matthew. This is all Diana's feeling. But this is Diana's, like, okay, like Matthew feels he has not expressed himself to her yet with these words, but Matthew has felt mated in some way for a time now. This is her, I think. I don't know if it's a witch thing or just a Diana thing, but this is her feeling of this formal connection. Physical, formal, and soul connection. And I think it is one of the most beautiful things that Deb has. And depending on what's going on in the story, in the book, in the books, it takes different forms, right? This chain comes back, and it comes back in happy times. It comes back in sad times. It comes back in really emotional, deep, dramatic times. And it always is reflective of her relationship toward him. And that's, it's so gorgeous. It's so gorgeous the way she said that, the way she expresses, describes that. And here Summer gets her druggy time.
Why are you going to put it like that?
Because you wanted to jump to the drugs.
I tried to make it all pretty.
And you're like, drugs!
I didn't say it was my favorite part of the chapter. I was insinuating it was yours.
I understand that.
Huh?
Ginger.
Summer, that's even worse. Oh, so it's okay when you insinuate it's mine, but it's not okay when I insinuate it's yours?
No. When you just said, I didn't say it was my favorite part of the chapter. I was insinuating it was yours. It doesn't matter what you say or don't say is your own favorite. That's up to you. But to say that you were only saying it was mine, like, that's not nice, Summer.
I never said I was nice.
That is true. He has her take a sedative. And she's covered up in a blanket and he has her all comfy and he takes her in his arms. Quote, I could still feel the chain that anchored me to Matthew, witch to vampire, with the links of the chain tight and shining. I slept, unquote. And that's something else. Okay, I love it. That is something else. So not only the existence of that chain, that anchor, but the tightness or those are the things that that can change. So the heaviness of it, the tightness or looseness, and its brilliance. So whether it's shining, whether it's tarnished, whether it's not damaged, but darker. So those are the things that change during the story at different times when Deb brings up this chain. Oh, it's gorgeous. I love it. And I'm not going to lie. Because we know Diana, Diana's a Leo and she was born in 1976. So I think she was born in August. So we're not 100% birthday twins, but I'm a Leo born in around that year. As I give away that thing. Anyway, so I guess I'm just giving everything away. So anyway, but to hear him say, I don't necessarily have a tie, like a personal tie. Obviously, she's fictional, but I don't have like a personal, like emotional tie to the character of Diana, like extra specially. But she is my sign, and we do share a sign, and we share, I'll just say it, I guess, and we share a birth year. So she, I'm obviously not a historian of science or an alchemical like wizard or genius. But some of the things that at least I am an unapologetic daddy's girl, and the older I get, mommy's girl. But talking about, this kills me. We can't say too much more because we don't want to. I mean, you probably already read the books, but in case you haven't, Summer will back me up on this. I'm a stickler for not getting ahead. But as I said earlier, so one of the themes of this book is mother or motherhood, and then the next book, father or fatherhood, and then the third book, parents or family. And so, yeah, it's a beautiful road. It's a rocky road, not in a negative sense, in a true to life sense. These stories have emotional ups, emotional downs, and there's a lot of Kleenex, but there's so many things. There's like in any good story, there's a lot of Kleenex, there's a lot of celebration, there's a lot of beautiful things. So I'm so excited to get on, continue with this chapter. I mean, excuse me, that's it. So excited to continue with this book.
So that was chapter 15. Join us next time when we will be discussing chapter 16, in which we learn a little more about our friend Marcus.
Just a smidgel.
And we have a Hamilton reference coming in.
You're going to give it up now?
No, of course not.
Like, you don't need to give me any encouragement. If you plant that seed now, you know it's too late. So one of the things that I'm not sure we mentioned it in our last episode, but probably not because we hadn't announced our group yet when we had recorded the last episode. But we have a wonderful and growing Facebook community that we would absolutely love to have you in. And we chat about anything, the announcements, our show, but that's really kind of on the, that's like kind of on the, on not the down low, but that's definitely like not the major thing at all that we talk about. It's mostly basically anything and everything. We want to hear from you guys. We want to get to know you guys and have you share your favorite things and parts of your life and how this book has affected you, all of that. So if you would love to join us in our exclusive Facebook community and get to know some other amazing people, our international community, as we now know, you can find us at allsoulspod.com/group. And we or one of our moderators will get you in as soon as possible. So thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.